Welcome, I am Ben Trefney sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night in a press conference, the St. Louis County Prosecutor, Robert McCullough, announced that the grand jury had decided not to indict the white police officer Darren Wilson for the August 9th fatal shooting of the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. Soon after the announcement, thousands of people took to the streets to protest the grand jury's decision and to voice their solidarity with the people of Ferguson, but generally, media outlets have focused their attention on scenes of violence unfolding in that town and around the country. 4 months ago, the fatal shooting of Michael Brown set off a national conversation about racial profiling, about inequality, and about the militarization of U.S. police forces. So where is that conversation today? And what are the broader implications of the grand jury's decision in Ferguson? We're going to be joined today by Michael Denzel Smith. He's a contributing writer at The Nation and a freelance writer and social commentator. Michael joins us on the phone from New York. Good to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined on the phone from Ferguson by Mariah Stewart, who's a Huffington Post Ferguson Fellow. Good to have you back, Mariah.
Thank you.
And from Oakland, we're joined by Alice Simmons. She's Executive Director of Youth Uprising, an East Oakland youth center offering a wide range of programs and services that develop leadership and combat racial tensions and violence among Oakland youth. Welcome to the program, Alice.
Thrilled to be here.
Great. We also want to hear from you, all of you in the audience. How should we respond to this? Join the conversation today at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. That's www.yourcallradio.org. And Mariah, I'd like to start with you. Are you in Ferguson right now?
Yes, I am.
And you've been reporting on the protests there soon after that fatal shooting of Michael Brown on August 9th. Last night, a lot of us saw the TV screens, the internet were filled with scenes of cars and buildings set on fire, and you were there. What did you see?
I seen so much happen last night. I seen tear gas, or smoke gas, as police want to call it. I did see young men breaking windows of businesses. I heard gunshots. Just lots of things transpiring over the course of the night.
And what's it like there this morning as the sun rose?
Right now, you'll see a lot of people cleaning up. You'll get a really good feel of community here. People are trying to accurately represent the city and not portray what happened last night.
What would you say is the accurate representation of Ferguson?
The accurate representation is basically everyone's hurt right now. They felt that this decision was going to be a non-indictment. It came out to be a non-indictment. So you just see people pretty much mourning something. They want to change, and it's a definitely mournful atmosphere here.
Mm-hmm. And before that, I'm curious too, before August, what was Ferguson like from your perspective?
Ferguson was a nice community. Of course, everyone here has their ups and downs with police. If you ask anyone, it seems like they had a story to tell about a court experience gone bad or a police experience gone bad.
Mm-hmm. That is Mariah Stewart, who's a Huffington Post Ferguson Fellow. And let's talk now for a moment with Michael Denzel Smith, who writes for The Nation. You were in Ferguson recently, and you say that people there did not expect an indictment. I'm wondering, what did the grand jury decision mean for people who live in Ferguson and their experiences with the police and the justice system?
Well, it essentially means that, whether there was an indictment or not, meaning is the same. The work to undo the harassment and terrorizing of the black community in Ferguson and St. Louis has to continue. Because whether, even with an indictment of Darren Wilson, that's one cop being held accountable for one shooting in one town in the United States. And I think that they all are seeing this as part of something larger. They're seeing it as a part of the continued criminalization of black youth in this country, and then the death of those black youth with impunity. And so the organizing work that's going on down there was going to continue whether or not Darren Wilson was indicted, and that what you're going to see now, I believe, is more support for them. I think that with this decision, the resources could actually flow in that they need, because people see the injustice. Now, had Darren Wilson been indicted, maybe people would have brushed this away and said, okay, well, that's handled. But with this non-indictment, you can see very clearly the differences in the way that our justice system treats black people versus everyone else, and the way that deference is paid to law enforcement, even in the use of extreme force, lethal force, and the ways in which, I mean, we're also going to see these moves towards demilitarization of the police, because that was another story that came out of it, one that I think overshadowed the death of Michael Brown in some instances. But it was also a major piece of this is the ways in which police tried to suppress people's right to free speech and assembly, and have continued to do so over the past 3.5 months. You're going to see a lot of pushes towards demilitarization of the police, because it's one thing that has broad support on from different political ideologies as well.
And it's been quite a while now that the military has been donating excess and outdated gear that they've been using internationally to police departments. This is a big issue in California as well. And that brings us to Ala Simmons. I'm wondering, from your standpoint in Oakland, what was your reaction to that non-indictment decision by the grand jury yesterday?
Well, of course, I'm saddened. I think that all conscious people across the world are saddened by it, but I don't know that any of us are shocked. When you look at the way to the dialogue that we've heard nationally, the way that when people came into Ferguson they were treated, the way that the Ferguson police had moved in relationship to their citizens, the lack of representation of the population in the police force, in the courts, in the elected realm, it's not surprising, but it absolutely is devastating.
Mm-hmm. And for people who you work with, tell me about the people who you work with in East Oakland, Alice.
So East Oakland is the story of many places across the country, a community that was once affluent, and people could graduate from high school and get a really high-wage, low-skill job, mostly in food manufacturing. And as the land use policies changed, demographics changed, we had white flight to the suburbs, and the community became incredibly disinvested and predominantly black. It is now a black and brown community. And the people that we work with are young people who are at the epicenter of violence, who find themselves fully and utterly locked out of the American dream and hope and possibility. High rates of school failure, the leading cause of death in this community for people 13 to 34 is homicide. We've got very poor housing quality stock. Like, all of the bad indicators are co-located in this one place. And as a result of that, we have forged a series of relationships with all of the public and private stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. That is Ala Simmons from Youth Uprising in Oakland. And we'd like you to join the conversation today by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Or 866-798-8255. You could also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. That's yourcallradio.org. So we just heard about the program Youth Uprising in Oakland, which I want to talk a little bit more about later, because it really does serve as a communication medium, too, between young people who are living in East Oakland and the police, which I think is something that has often been missing from these conversations. Mariah, do you see similar programs, or is there a similar dialogue that's in place in Ferguson, or is that broken?
As far as community organization and helping youth?
And conversations where bridges can be made between the people who are there, who are hurt, and the police, who they mistrust?
Well, Brown's death did create a lot of grassroots organizations developing, whereas their missions are to help better the community in that way. So there has been a lot of actions taking place to help provide that.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of strong organizing in Ferguson. I understand some people there went to the UN in Geneva to talk about this. Is that right?
Yes, that's true.
Could you tell me a little more about that?
Well, Brown's Mike Brown's parents had went to Geneva to put their case before the UN, and just to really just get across the problem of police brutality in America. It wasn't strictly just for Brown, as Leslie McFadden, Brown's mom, said. She said it was for all of the young black men who have been killed in the hands of police.
And tell me about a little bit more about the community organizing taking place in Ferguson right now, if you would.
Right now, a lot of people are cleaning up. They just want to paint a better picture of the St. Louis region. And underground, there's a lot of organizations just trying to better the community.
Mm-hmm. In what ways?
For instance, some protesters have organized meetings to talk with police chiefs, to have a Q&A session so that they can hear each other out. Others, you know, have, created educational program sessions so that people can know how to act and know their rights, know the law a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've been talking about here, and one of the undercurrents that's been taking place during the last several months in Ferguson and really elsewhere, is the racial makeup of the police force, of law enforcement in that area, compared with the population. It is law enforcement has largely been white. I mean, it's been extraordinarily disproportionate, while the population of Ferguson is largely black. So are there, is there a sense that communication is really happening then, or are people just speaking, you know, from different perspectives, practically different languages?
I feel like you can say that. It's several people have described they feel the meeting, it's a step forward, but they really feel like it's going in one ear through the other by law officials.
Well, that must be extremely frustrating for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because of that, I mean, the problem stems further than just the police force. You also have this misrepresentation also in the courtrooms as well. You have judges that play the roles as prosecutors as well in different municipalities, and it just kind of conflicts with each other.
Michael, with your observations from around the country, do you see this all around the country, or is it more specific to Ferguson?
Well, the issues of the municipalities is something that, and people being able to serve as judge and prosecutor in one county, and a judge in one county and prosecutor in another county, that's something that seems pretty specific to this area. But the issue of interactions with the police and young black people, yeah, I mean, this is a nationwide problem. But I think that that asking that relationships be better, that people talk to, I want young black people to have less interactions with police. I don't want them to have to sit down in rooms and like explain and justify their humanity to police officers. I want police officers to already have that sense, also just to have less responsibility in terms of what it is that they're trying to do. I think that what the problem that we see is what this stems from is the idea that police officers can go into communities and they can stop crime. And so that then lends itself to them identifying people that they're going to suspect as criminals. And who are they going to target? It's going to be people that are then stereotyped but through racist bias to be perceived as criminals. I think that, we have a duty to decriminalize a lot of the activities that we have criminalized in this country that are particularly harmless or only inflict injury on the person that participates in them, and to deal with some of our social ills without intervention from police. So we have police intervening in cases of homelessness and people being out in the street when the solution to homelessness isn't to lock people up, it's to get them home. The solution to drug use is to not lock people up, it's to get them help. the solution to mental illness is not to lock people up, it's to get them therapy. The solution to people, to poverty and the things that that are the source of a lot of crime in high crime areas, it's not to lock people up. And I think that that's the issue that we're having, is that we keep going back to this one source as a solution to all of our problems without dealing with the root causes. And police are just simply not equipped to handle and to deter crime in any significant way, or deter these activities in any significant way. And we've criminalized so many things instead of dealing with the actual problem.
Thank you, Michael. And Alice, I'm really interested to hear your perspective on what he had to say there.
You know, I agree with all of it, but I think that Ferguson isn't alone. Oakland is Ferguson. I mean, you look around the world, and so Mark Dugan is shot, and there's a riot in the UK. We have uprisings in Paris. We have Oscar Grant in Oakland. Like, we have failed as a, I'd argue, as a world, to deal with race. So implicit bias, the way in the transcript that the officer, Darren Wilson, talked about Mike Ferguson as if he were a beast, it played to America's bias about black people. Here is Wilson, who's 6'4 and over 200 pounds, who says, I felt like I was 5. He was Hulk Hogan. The boy is 10 years plus younger than you, and he's 2 inches taller. But we believe that he looked like a demon as a nation. We believe that he had superhuman strength. We believe that he was a threat 10 feet away. And we've got to talk about the fact that we believe that black people are dangerous, that the very existence of a black man, and frankly as a black woman, I feel it all the time. I'm dangerous by my being. Because we've not talked about race. We've not talked about, it's not accidental that there are really an inappropriate number of black folks elected and in the courts and on the police force in Ferguson. That's not accidental. That is intentional. And we have to get underneath the shootings and talk about what makes it okay for us to treat one segment of our population so very differently. How is this different than lynching? How is this different than what happened after Reconstruction? It's not. It's not different than the riots in the 60s before the passage of the civil rights bills. And we have not come as far as we want to pretend. And we keep hiding behind, well, I have a black president, so things are different. In fact, it's not true. I'd argue that Mike Brown is a backlash from the election of a black man. And so I want us to really come to a place where we're not using police as a way to deal with our social problems, but that we're actually dealing with them ourselves.
That's Alla Simmons from Youth Uprising in Oakland. And I'd like to go to our first caller today, and that is Joseph. Joseph in Berkeley, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to say, with all due respect, that to talk about the people sitting down with the police and hearing each other out sounds like a very liberal solution, and actually ignores the true role of the police historically and continually as a street enforcement arm of white supremacy in America. And I've written about the police several times. Listeners can Google Joseph Anderson plus Oscar Grant March, or Joseph Anderson plus karmic justice. And what, you know, what the Ferguson decision shows yesterday and these continual failures to indict and convict wrongful police show is that black and brown Americans have no legal recourse to the so-called justice system. The police have become the institutional KKK in blue. And this country has made it clear that with the slightest that with the slightest pretext, the police can, with impunity, legally murder black and brown people.
I think that is definitely a sense that is happening quite a lot in the nation right now. Thank you, Joseph, for that call. Let's go to another call on line 3, William in Belvedere.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hear a whole lot of what I'd call venting and complaining. The piece that I'm missing ever hearing about is we have a community that is 75% black. We have a police in Ferguson, a police force that has 4 blacks and 54 whites on it. If this was a community where 75% of the population was Jewish or Italian, and the police were beating up Jewish or Italians, you could bet that the Jews or the Italians would simply vote to put in power a government which would hire police that would stop beating up Jews and Italians. I cannot understand, and I would appreciate the perspectives of the person from Ferguson, as to why that same thing does not take place in Ferguson.
All right. Thank you very much, William. And Mariah, since he just... go ahead, please.
Because there are municipalities in that same area with majority black populations and black representation in their governments and in their police forces, and the same exact things are taking place. This is not an issue of whether or not the racial makeup of those in power reflects those who are being governed. It's an issue of power being exercised in a racist way. It is disproportionately affecting the community that is mostly black. This is the thing. I think we have to get past this idea that voting is going to solve the problem, because you can vote. You're going to vote in essentially people whose job it is maintenance of the state and the state as it is. We have to understand the state in a new way in order to get people in office that will uphold that new vision for the state. And I think that's the challenge here, as opposed to simply getting a racial makeup that reflects the community.
Thank you very much. Michael Smith from The Nation. And Mariah Stewart, before you go, because you're going to be leaving at 1:30, I think. Mariah Stewart, from Huffington Post in Ferguson. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, about that disproportionate makeup and what could be done about that racially with the police force and the people of Ferguson.
I think the gentleman before me did coin it that, you know, although it may be a racial problem, it also happens with black officers as well, and it's, it seems to be an abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that, you know, could then improve that if it's an abuse of power, not a racial thing? Do you think that people in Ferguson feel empowered to elect representatives who maybe represent their interests a little bit better?
I feel, from what I hear, that it's pretty much you're choosing from the lesser of two evils with your voting. That's what people have told me on the streets. So I feel like hope is just pretty much out the window for this community.
That is Mariah's,
when it comes to their voting process.
That is Mariah Stewart from the Huffington Post, who is in Ferguson. We are also speaking with Michael Denzel Smith, who is a contributing writer at The Nation, and Alla Simmons from Youth Uprising in East Oakland. We are also looking for your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We're talking about the grand jury decision not to indict Darren Wilson in Ferguson for the shooting of Michael Brown, and you are listening to Your Call.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. Toll-free, 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can send your email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes from the BBC, World Have Your Say. And on today's program, the discussion of the situation in Ferguson will continue. That's coming up on the BBC's World Have Your Say at 11.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the ongoing protests in Ferguson and around the country after a St. Louis County grand jury brought no criminal charges against Darren Wilson, a white police officer who fatally shot the unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown on August 9th. I'm Ben Trefney, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll rebroadcast a conversation about how people of color are significantly underrepresented in environmental groups, especially at the leadership level. A recent study calls it a quote-unquote green ceiling, noting that people of color make up only 12 to 16% of most environmental organizations. How is this affecting the priorities and strategies of the environmental movement? That's a discussion for tomorrow on Your Call. If you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And that's the number where you can reach us now to talk about the developing situation in Ferguson, the implications of the grand jury's decision not to bring any criminal charges against Darren Wilson. Michael Denzel Smith is a contributing writer at The Nation and a freelance writer and social commentator. He's with us on the phone from New York. And we also have had Mariah Stewart, a Huffington Post Ferguson fellow, who I think has gone for now back to work, and Ola Simmons from Youth Uprising in Oakland. And we have a caller on the line. That is Molly in Carmel. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for this discussion. It just breaks my heart that instead of protecting and serving, that our police are starting to act like an occupation force. And in Iraq, we've shown how we occupy. I mean, that's what the Israeli police force has become. And a lot of police forces are sending their, are getting trained over in Israel, which is very concerning. And also, some of, just as a point of information, a lot of these arms are coming from private companies. It isn't all just a military used vehicles and things.
Thank you for that, Molly. You were speaking about how you think, Michael, that there will be a demilitarization of police forces. Can you expand on that a little bit, please?
I think there will be a push towards demilitarization of the police, but I think that we're at a point where it's so far gone that they like their toys. They use them. I mean, they're provisions that say, you know, if you don't use these things within the year, you have to return them. I mean, they're using them not even because of their necessity, but because they like having them around. And to the caller's point, I just would like to point out that, you know, police have been an occupying force in black communities. Like, this is not new. These black communities are the training grounds for all of these things that we see that seep out into the broad. Like, when we saw during Occupy, we saw police forces using these type of tactics that, you know, drew attention to the militarization of police. But those are things that have been happening in black communities for decades, in response to the so-called war on drugs, in response to the Watts riots, which then the Watts rebellions that implemented the creation of SWAT teams. Like, these are things that have been happening in black communities for a long time. So even if there is no militarization of police, even if we do demilitarize the police, we take away their tanks, we take away their assault rifles, we take away all of these toys that they've become accustomed to having, they can do the damage that they need to do without that. It's a matter of directives and what they're supposed to be accomplishing. I mean, I was in Ferguson last week, and I was at direct actions that happened nightly at the police station, and the police played this little cat and mouse game where they stood in a line of about 50 police officers. They would advance on protesters and stand there, and then they would advance again, arrest a couple people, and then back up. Like, that's without any tear gas. That's without any use of guns or rubber bullets or what have you. That was just this violence being enacted on those protesters just because. The militarization of the police is sort of becomes this distraction. Well, I mean, it's an issue. Obviously, you don't want to have tanks rolling down American streets the way that they do and terrorizing people, but the police can do their damage without those things.
And we've, of course, seen that in Oakland as well. And I'm not sure if there were armored vehicles on the streets. I know we had some reporters from KALW who were out there in Oakland and did not see that kind of thing, though obviously there were a lot of military tactics that were used on the 580 freeway, which was blocked off by protesters. Let's go to another call. This is Alexis in Salinas.
Hi, I just want to bring up the point that this is not really a war against race. So, you know, there is racism involved with this, but I think it's more along the lines that it's a war against poverty and the thinking that people that live in poverty have, because they make a lot of irrational decisions. Because when you live in poverty, and all these people, it's clear that they're going through this. They make decisions where it's a fight against everybody. So whoever threatens them is not. They don't necessarily reflect on what's going on and analyze the situation. Instead, they take flight on anything that's going on with them. And then, I've experienced this too, because when I was young, I used to get harassed a lot. I grew up in Salinas, and, you know, the police often harass us, and the police are Mexican too. So it's not really it's not really race involved. It's more of, you know what you're doing in the streets is illegal. You know what you're doing is wrong, and you know people are trying to combat you, and that's the way you feel. So you feel that you got to fight back. But after I learned my education, I realized, you know, this is not the right way to do it. You know, you got to learn. Even if they try to harass you, you know, you got to teach them. You know, I'm a just person. I'm not a criminal. Just because I look like, you know, I'm poor or whatever it is, you know, you can't treat me this way.
Thank you very much, Alexis. Those are interesting insights, and I'd like to hear from Alla Simmons with her thoughts in working with people in similar situations.
You know, it's such an interesting dynamic in America when you really look at it. I absolutely agree that this is an issue of poverty and the containment of poor people. And when you talk to police officers, they'll tell you, even the black and the brown police officers, that they've joined a paramilitaristic force, and that they themselves, as black and brown people, don't feel safe within that. And that's well documented. There have been many people of color on the force who have been shot and killed wrongly by other officers when off duty. So we can see this in a complicated way, which we should, that this is about poverty, and it's not fully about race. But the truth is, when you look at the disproportionality of poverty in America, it comes back again to race. It's black and brown people who are trapped in poverty, that are on the slippery slope of poverty because of failing educational institutions, because of disproportionate arrests that affect a person's ability to get a job. And so I really encourage us to think about race, but race not from a purely black and white or brown and black standpoint. People institutionalize and internalize racism. And so when black officers are more aggressive with black people or brown people than they are with white people, that's a manifestation of their own internalized oppression. Like, we have to begin to think about just the data. When you look at the data, people of all races look at black people and say, that couldn't have hurt them the same way that hurt a white person. That was a menacing move, when the movements are exactly the same regardless of race, because we have a way that we think about people of color. And that's true even when we are people of color. So I don't dispute that poverty is an important element here. And I want to just add this, that this is all what happens between human beings. And until we begin to have conversations as human beings and bring humanity back into this, I think that we're stuck here. I agree that while the militarization of the police is a problem, you didn't need a tank in Mississippi in the 50s, and people were still terrorized. It's about how do we treat each other. And so I think that conversations between communities that are disenfranchised and are disproportionately impacted by police behavior and police is not a liberal approach. I think it's an important human approach.
Thank you. That's Alla Simmons from Youth Uprising in Oakland. And just to add a statistic here, in the United States, young black men between the ages of 15 and 19 are 21 times more likely to be shot by police officers than young white men of the same age. So whatever the reasons are, that number is remarkable and horrifying. And also, you referred earlier, Alice, to some of the testimony before the grand jury by Darren Wilson, and it's a pretty remarkable read to see what his perspective was in really dehumanizing Michael Brown in his eyes because of fear or because of whatever reasons there were. And it does speak to some of the perspectives that you're sharing there, Alice.
I'm afraid that Darren was coached into that, because when you read the testimony, it plays very emotionally to people's fears of black men.
That is Alice Simmons. And we're going to turn now to Adam Hudson, who is a journalist, writer, and photographer based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Adam, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
And you were at the protest in Oakland last night. I'm wondering if you could share some thoughts of what you saw.
Yeah, you know, I've been seeing a lot of coverage about, like, how it's been framed as, like, oh, that there was, like, violence and property destruction. I think, you know, for the most part, I thought the protest was very lively, energetic, passionate, and dedicated, and there is this very much like unified message from people of all walks of life. It's a very diverse crowd. The unifying message was that, you know, Michael Brown did not deserve to be killed. The verdict was unjust, and Black Lives Matter. Like that, I think those are like the three like key points of the protest. In terms of property destruction and all that, you know, they're really, I think the press like makes kind of blows that out of proportion. Out of what I saw on the ground when people were protesting, the worst that happened were people spray painting phrases like F the police on walls and a trash can being lit entirely on fire. Now, I mean, you can debate like whether or not that was a good idea or not, but I think like that those instances don't amount to like say a full-scale riot or riot or unrest. So I think, you know, when the press talks about violence in the protests, I thought it was pretty minimal. And but I will say though that I think the police provoked the protests because they kept blocking intersections, particularly 7th and Broadway, very early on. Like people were just, you know, in the beginning it was a very like typical march. I've been in these kinds of protests a lot, and like it was a very typical march going down Broadway. Then police blocked 7th and Broadway. Then protesters turned down another street, and then met another police blockade near freeway wrenches. Then people turned around, went back to near Oscar Grant Plaza, and then, you know, marched further down. And so, like, I think the police tactics and what they did, I think they provoked people and escalated the situation. And when protesters went on the I-580, there are a lot of cars honking in support. So, you know, even if people think that, like, oh, it was, like, you know, kind of rowdy or unruly that protesters are blocking the freeway. I mean, out of the people who are on the freeway, who are in their cars, there are a lot of people honking in support. And then, you know, after that, the police, I think, got much more aggressive. I think that escalated the situation. But,
well, I do know that in the Bay Area, police are very conscious of traffic problems. You could just see how quickly they hustle people off the Bay Bridge whenever there's any kind of accident. But yeah, some supporters and certainly some frustrated people. I'm interested in hearing if you were caught in that traffic, if you were in the protest, if you were a police officer in Oakland or in Santa Cruz or anywhere around Northern California. I'm really interested to hear what thoughts you have on the aftermath of this decision yesterday. The phone number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. There's a lot of talk about how police are acting. If you are a police officer, very interested to hear your perspective. Let's go ahead to Jeff on the line. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, let me add something. I spent all my working career in management consulting for corporations, but there's something they call corporate culture. If you look at what police departments hire, they hire conservative people. If somebody that doesn't fit that profile somehow gets hired, they get drummed out, or they're likely to get drummed out. They're not going to fit. They have a very strong union, and there is in California a policeman's bill of rights. It makes it very hard for us policemen to be sued civilly when they do something wrong. That's another way of catching if you don't catch them criminally. And if there's a policeman killed, you sometimes see thousands of people coming, officers coming from all over the country, is a sign of force. Then take a look at the compensation. I lived in Berkeley for 40 years. If you take a look at the average, what I think, these figures can be borne out. I'm going to give you what I think are the figures that are most likely there. The average patrolman in Berkeley at the 5 or 10 year mark is probably $70,000 or $80,000 a year. There maybe is $20,000 in overtime, but the overhead, which is entirely separate from other city employees, is probably 50% for their retirement and for their lifetime medical. That's about $150,000 a year. These guys are in a special category. Last thing, and I had a private conversation about 10 years ago with an African-American police person in the Bay Area who described he was getting out. He didn't fit. He wasn't conservative enough. But when you get into those environments, they're very hard for an open-minded, liberal person that are most of the people listening to this show and that are calling in to put up with. I couldn't put up with it, yet that's a very good job. So you've got a militaristic mentality, and that's why they hire a lot of ex-military people coming up. All right, that's my point. And it's a completely different perspective that other people are bringing up, but it really fits into it. It's why these policemen will do what they do, an unnecessary force to shoot somebody like Mr. Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And I have to say, I lived in Clayton, Missouri for about a year and a half some years ago. I mean, it's a very nice area, some of those local areas.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Really appreciate your thoughts. And Aulis, I'm wondering, with your long-term perspective in Oakland, do you think that Oakland police are trained properly and enough to deal with the stressful situations that they are confronted with?
So the Oakland Police Department would probably say no, that they're working towards it, but no. I have to say that I'm shocked that I'm in a deep and meaningful relationship with the police department because of my own political beliefs, my own view of the world, in the population that I hold dear. But what I found was I'd be in a lot of policy meetings, and the only people that would really understand what was the truth on the ground was my team and the police. A lot of people come to this work around public safety and community building that have a very theoretical academic view of it. But the truth on the ground is the face of devastation. And so over the years, I've built a strong working relationship with them. And what I understand is that police officers and young people are both trying to get home alive at the end of the evening. And while there's a disproportionate power that police have over young people, the truth is that we have to figure out a way, since our tax dollars are going to it anyhow, to have that force not be an occupying force, but a useful force to create public safety. So I think not. I will say that the police department has engaged Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt from Stanford, who has an amazing body of research.
She's a MacArthur Award winner this year.
Absolutely, and extraordinarily honored to be working with her because she's giving them a view into their own data and their own behavior. And I don't know another police force that's doing that. So while I take some issue with them, and am happy to do that publicly and privately, I can see them internally struggling with the legacy of racism in that department and the legacy of disproportionate force use in that department and beginning to think about what can we do to be different. And that's as good as it gets in America.
All right. Let's go to Adam. Your thoughts to follow up on what we're talking about here, Adam, in Oakland.
Yeah, you know, I think what needs to be put in context is that, you know, for me personally, I don't think the verdict was not that surprising. I mean, the moves that the state of Missouri was making kind of like indicated that there was going to be a there wasn't going to be a they weren't going to you know, indict Darren Wilson. But this is a lot bigger than Mike Brown. Like every 28 hours, according to a study by the Malcolm X Grassroots Project movement, and every 28 hours a black person is killed by a police officer, security guard, or a self-employed vigilante. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just like one study. There are other studies that show that basically, like, police officers far too often kill black people in this country for reasons that are, you know, very suspect. And it's not even just police officers. Like, the police officers are just one part of the American criminal justice system. From, you know, prosecutors and judges, they also play a role in disproportionately criminalizing and over-incarcerating people of color. The United States has the largest prison population in the entire world at over 2.4 million people. Most of those people are people of color, and most of the offenses that they're in there for are usually for drug offenses or other low-level offenses. Usually violent offenses like murder and property destruction, those are, as a percentage-wise, those are like around 10 or 15% of people who are arrested and incarcerated.
And interestingly, to that point, Adam, I was just going to say that voters just recently have changed some of the laws in California to decriminalize a bit some of the long incarcerated sentences that people have been experiencing in California. And part of that is, of course, to deal with the overpopulation issue in prisons. But also, I think there might be a bit of a change, which brings us back to Michael from The Nation, Michael Smith, because you were talking about how there could be a little changing tide as far as public sentiment over some of these issues.
Yeah, I think Prop 47 is one of those things that goes in the right direction. It's not a total decriminalization of drugs or even marijuana, but it's a move to say, you know, we can't deal with this problem this way. And to take the money that's going to be saved by not prosecuting all of these low-level drug crimes and putting that money into mental health institutions, putting that money into the education system where we can actually affect real change. I think that those are the type of things that you can do to chip away, right? So I don't think that putting body cameras on police is going to stem the tide, and it's going to completely change everything about the way that the police go about doing their job. But it's one form of accountability that's a step in the right direction to say that police officers need to be held accountable. And so if we can get that type of thing going, you know, we're going to have to fight on the little for the little victories, I think, in terms of how we affect change. We're not going to see the overhaul of the system in one fell swoop. It's going to be these little pieces of the criminal justice system, of mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, being chipped away at little by little of the police state to say, okay, well, you know, we can try to take away their armored vehicles, or we can try to take away the use of rubber bullets or something like that. Those little things over time will get people on to understand just how abusive this system is and just how racist this system is, and we can then have that bigger conversation about how to overturn it all.
All right. That is Michael Smith from The Nation magazine. Let's go to another caller from Salinas. This is Margie. Margie, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call and for having this conversation today. I live in Salinas, and you know, the majority of the population here is a strong Latino agricultural-based, you know, immigrant population. And in the past year, we've had four officer-involved shootings within a four-month period that brought a lot of unrest. And since then, there have been others that have been added to that, which have involved taser deaths and so forth. I can tell you that, you know, having watched this whole thing and what's going on, it's very true that it isn't just black men. It's people of color and people in poverty. And the majority of the people in poverty are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody earlier who mentioned that once they got an education, they could see things a little bit differently. The problem is that people of color usually are denied access to higher education. And so when you're put in that kind of you know, situation, and when the whole system is set against you, for example, the whole justice system, the way it's set against you, if you end up in a court, you end up in juvenile hall, or you end up in the prison system. Now, here locally, we have people that are living in the shadows who are afraid to come out and voice their opinion about what's happened, and they're disgust because they're afraid of being deported. So, and even when you look at the language that police officers use on reports in order to justify their actions, they have this cookie cutter language. And I can tell you that whoever helped Darren Wilson put together his particular, when he testified in front of the grand jury, words that were used, I felt he was like Hulk Hogan, I felt like a five-year-old. These are all racist type things. Hulk Hogan is white, but you're supposed to envision this big black guy coming at you and reach into that primordial fear that you have of, you know, it's all racist. And so the system is very much set against people who are impoverished. And what you see happening in Ferguson and really all over is as I heard a reverend put it very well, he said, this is what hopelessness looks like. When people feel that they have nowhere to go, the system that is not there for them, it's against them, this is what it looks like. It's like those people that they lock up in solitary confinement. After a while, they hit their heads against the wall and they make themselves bleed and they go crazy.
Thank you very much, Margie. Yeah, I want to, just because we're running out of time, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I would like to hear some final thoughts from our guests. Michael Smith, she talked about hopelessness, but it doesn't sound like you see this as hopeless.
No, I don't. I think that there's definitely a sense of despair, and there's a sense that, you know, there's a tiring, there's an exhaustion of fighting against this system that is unwilling to change. But there's not hopelessness on the ground in Ferguson, and I think that that's extending to all of the protests and demonstrations across the country. I think that people are seeing, more and more people are seeing the abuses of the system, and more people are agitated, and more people are being uncomfortable with it, and that is moving people to action. And that action is not not the result of there being hopelessness, but the result of the desire for change leading to a hope. And I don't even want to say hope. I think that there's a sense of urgency that is driving this, and that people want change to happen very quickly, and they're willing to fight for it.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael Smith and Alla Simmons. You're going to have to find her work online, but we really appreciate you being here. You could go to yourcallradio.org to see that. Jennifer Eberhardt's work from Stanford, the grand jury testimony we've been talking about. We've been speaking with Michael Smith from The Nation, Mariah Stewart from The Huffington Post, and Alla Simmons from Youth Uprising, as well as Adam Hudson. Thank you all for spending some time with us. Thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm very sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Ben Trefney, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. How can we improve diversity in environmental organizations? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how people of color are significantly underrepresented in environmental groups, especially at the leadership level. A recent study calls it a green ceiling, noting that people of color make up only 12 to 16% of most environmental organizations. How is this affecting the priorities and strategies of the environmental movement? Join us on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.